Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we're going to speak with talented author Nicholas Diak, and we're going to talk about pop culture, American culture, his essays, and a book that he's currently co-writing with Michelle Brittany about horror literature. Hi, Nick. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Good afternoon, Sherry. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really happy to have you. I mean, your stuff is very interesting. How did you start writing essays on popular culture? What brought that about for you?
I think it was when I went back to school to pursue my master's. My earlier education was more IT-oriented, but I went back to school to pursue a master's in interdisciplinary arts, and I began essay writing for my various classes. And I wound up really enjoying it, critically looking at a topic. In this case, I focused on Italian films. And when it was all said and done, I had a completed master's thesis on a movie called Castle of Blood. And I was very proud of it. And at the same time, while pursuing my master's, I was attending various conferences, the Popular Culture, American Culture Association conferences, expanding my own academia, but also, you know, presenting my research to others. And I've really found the process, you know, fulfilling creatively. I was able to, like, you know, contribute to something I thought was greater than me, you know, a knowledge base greater than me. I think that was kind of the fostering elements to put me on that career path, that afterwards, like, I want to continue to do this. I want to continue to write essays for various books and hopefully, you know, spearhead my own books down the line, which I eventually did.
That's really interesting. You know, it's always interesting how people get started to me. One of the hardest things to do is to face the blank page on either a piece of paper or a computer. Were you always a writer when you were a kid?
Kind of. I remember when I was a very small kid, you know, just in elementary school, you know, I attended a couple young authors conferences. I think I wrote a couple short stories, but it wasn't anything I wanted to, you know, wasn't anything I was pursuing. I wasn't writing in my free time. I wasn't pursuing it as like a serious endeavor. You know, growing up, my fixation was mostly on tech, gaming, reading films, and so on and so forth. So it wasn't until way, way later in my adulthood that I actually caught the, you know, writing bug, so to speak.
So you were a big reader. What kind of reading do you do? What's your favorite genre? And do you like to switch it up? Do you like to read all different kinds of books, or do you focus on one type of book?
Well, to be honest, for many, many years, it was reading mostly film studies books. So it's only been in the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years that I'm like, you know, you can actually read for fun. So
yeah.
I've mostly been diving into, it's kind of nice to sit there on a couch and, like, not have to take notes and annotate later. Say, like, right now, I've been visiting the sword and planet genre, the stuff pioneered by Edgar Rice Burroughs and later by Lynn Carter. I would say that's kind of like my for fun reading right now is that genre. But I still think I wind up reading a whole bunch of film texts for fun anyway. It's like, oh, this looks like a great film study. Let's read that.
I love film. Do you have a period or a type of movie that you like?
Since I focus so much of my studies on Italian genre cinema, I do have a soft spot for Italian films of the 50s and 60s, the sword and sandal films, the Euro spy films, the gothic horror films, but at the same time also hold kind of like high art cinema, you know, on a pedestal. In fact, my two favorite movies would be Lars von Trier's Europa and Krzysztof Kieślowski's Three Colors Red. But at the same time, I love a good exploitation and grindhouse film.
Do you ever watch the classics or not interested?
No, my girlfriend Michelle watches a lot of silent cinema. So that means I also wind up watching a lot of silent cinema. So I do have a soft spot for some of the City Symphonies. I like golden age animation that was pioneered by Disney. I love old film noirs, especially Fritz Lang's film noirs, movies like While the City Sleeps. I would also say I like, you know, the kind of the new Hollywood cinema, the 70s that was coming out as well, the early Scorsese films, because that was kind of all pioneering for what we see as cinema today. Yeah. And of course, old Italian auteur films as well. You know, a good Fellini was always fun to watch. I would say, you know, movies like, you know, it's not that old, well, 30 years old, but like Cinema Paradiso would be a good film to say, a film that's an appreciation of film. Yeah, something like that.
Sounds like fun. And so you're both a reader and you like movies. I'm always asked because I do that too. How do you find time to do that? And my answer is always, if you love it, you make the time. Is that how you feel about it too?
It is tough making that transition from being a consumer to a creator of content. You know, ask me 10 years ago, most of my time would have been spent film watching or playing video games and just putting my creative efforts, you know, secondary because, you know, you come home from a long day of work, you kind of want to unwind and do something for you. But when you actually write something and, you know, have it published, have it cited, have it used by other folks, that kind of writing high that you get from that starts taking over the, you know, consumer portion of taking in media. So you want to make more and more stuff. So I find myself gravitating toward more, well, yeah, that's fun and all, but Nick, you really need to hunker in and start writing stuff because once it's all done, you'll have a finished product. It'll be well-received or leveraged by someone else. So that's something I kind of tell myself. So I find myself, you know, reading less, watching films less, playing video games less as I turn more focused to, you know, writing, essay building. But it's worth it for the end results to have a finished product in your hands. So it is a hard juggle because, you know, the day's woes of work or other, you know, whatever's going on, it's just nice to sit back and do something, you know, fun. But at the end, you do have to hunker in and create something. But it's tough. It is a tough balance.
Yeah, I agree. I was just thinking when you were saying that, one of the things that I found interesting in reading your information was your first book was about stuff from the 90s, such as Xena and Gladiator. I'm not a big secret. I'm a big Xena fan. What prompted you to write that book since it was your first one? And you said that it was a transition for you to start writing that.
Well, I made a promise to myself that I wanted to get my essays published in two other books or journals first before spearheading a book myself. You know, my girlfriend Michelle actually made the plunge. She just jumped in on the deep end and went with, you know, whatever book she was on. I'm a bit more conservative. I like to do something kind of in smaller steps to kind of gain my bearings. So my goal was, Nick, write two essays, get them published by, you know, a legit academic press or journal. Well, that time came. I had a couple essays and journals actually under my belt at the time, so it was time to hunker in. My initial project idea was on industrial music. And that's a genre of music I've been listening to since the 90s, so 20-plus years. And so I spent months putting together a proposal, an abstract, you know, how to promote the book, what I wanted to do with it. I meticulously detailed. Well, one day, what happened was the movie Gods of Egypt came out, and there was a lot of dialogue about the film. You know, its portrayal of, you know, white folks, you know, portraying ancient Egyptians, and it's, you know, and that sort of thing. It kind of raising the idea, is this appropriate, and so on and so forth. But it was raising kind of important questions, and it's, so I was talking to my girlfriend, and I'm like, these are kind of, you know, important things to ask about the genre. And then I just kind of realized, you know, not since Gladiator and 300 has the sword and sandal genre really been academically talked about. There's obviously something important here. It's generating dialogue. So I'm like, you know what, that sounds kind of interesting. You know, I studied sword and sandal films from Italy from the 50s. And so that night, I just put together a proposal really quick. I didn't spend too much time on it just because I thought, you know what I'll do? I'll send in two proposals to this publisher. This one I'd been working on for months, and this sword and sandal one I just kind of put together just as a backup because, hey, you know, who knows what will happen. That's the one they went with. They went with the sword and sandal one. And so, wait, I have a contract in hand on sword and sandal films of the 90s and 2000s. Now I got to deliver a book and become a subject matter expert in the genre really, really quick. And so the thing about me is once I am, like, locked on something, I am really locked on it. So I just spent almost a year and a half completely submerged in, you know, 90s and 2000s sword and sandals, sword and sorcery flicks and television shows. And so, but it was worth it. The outcome was I had this book now. I got to work with a whole bunch of other academics. I got to publish their work, you know, something that they could put on their academic CV to help them get tenure or whatever. I got to learn so much about a genre that I was only kind of like halfway into in the first place. I got to, you know, work one-on-one with a publisher. I get to have my library, my book in the library. This is a complete win-win when it was all done. And so, you know, a big confidence booster that when it was all said and done, I have a book. There's my name on the cover and everything. It's amazing. And I got to help other people and learn so much of the process.
I always think when you get your first book, it's sort of like a birthday or a holiday because it's a big deal when you get your first book in the mail and there's a, like a little box of books there for you. How did you feel when you got your first shipment?
You know, there was actually two points that I felt something kind of amazing. The first one was when I saw the cover of my book. My publisher, McFarlane, they're a great publisher for academic texts, but you got a 50-50 chance that the cover might be something generic because, you know, getting the rights to, like, to use photos can be kind of expensive. So, like, example, you know, if it's a book on James Bond studies, you know, one of their books just has a cover of, like, of a gun next to a martini glass on a table. That's, you know, it's pretty generic. There's nary a James Bond on it. So I was kind of, you know, I don't want to say worried, but my expectations were, you know, the cover of my book is probably going to be like some sand and there's a spear and a shield on it. And it says, you know, essays on sword and sandal films. And so when I actually saw the cover and it's, you know, the Rock from Hercules on it, I'm like, holy smokes, The Rock is on the cover of my book. How did they do that? And so I had a big meltdown on how awesome that was. And so, you know, that was a big high point. And then when I came home from work one day, you know, it was a big old box waiting for me from the publisher that contained all of my contributor copies because, you know, my book is made up of essays from other authors. So just opening up this box and there's, I think, 20, 25 books in it that you stack them all up and everything. It looks impressive. It was just kind of a really cool experience to hold, you know, this is a physical book, you know. There's going to be libraries with this on its shelf, you know, and I've had people ask me to sign their books and stuff like that. It is kind of surreal just because, you know, it wasn't a self-published endeavor. Not that there's anything wrong with self-publishing, but this was, you know, someone had the confidence in me to deliver a product that, you know, they felt other people could use, and here it is. And so it was quite surreal.
I always think it's exciting. It's just, I don't know. It's like a special present, even though you knew it was coming.
Well, it's funny. When my book came out about 1 or 2 months earlier, my girlfriend Michelle's book, Horror in Space, came out, and I have an essay in that book. And the way we chose to celebrate it was kind of funny. I'm not a wine drinker, so, you know, usually when you celebrate something, you have a glass of wine. Instead, I had a tin of cheese that had aged for, like, 9 years. Up in Washington at the Washington State University, they have a creamery, and they do a cheese called Cougar Gold. It's a very, very sharp white cheddar. And what they do is they put it in a tin, and they age it for a year, and they sell it, and they encourage you, you know, don't open it. Sit on this cheese, you know, sit on it for 1, 2, 10, 20 years because all it's going to do is age and get sharp. Well, when we first moved to California back in 2010, I bought a tin of this cheese. I've had it before. It's really good. It's very sharp. But I'm like, you know what? Someday down the road, we're going to have to celebrate something. And so I bought this tin of cheese, and it's set in our refrigerator for, well, 8 years, 2010 to 2018. And so we opened that up to celebrate our two books with, and it was delicious, but oh man, that cheese was like eating daggers because it was so sharp. So that's how we celebrated our books, was eating a tin of 9-year-old cheese. It was worth it.
That is unusual. Because I remember when I had my first book signing, it was Barnes & Noble, and my mom was still with us. And my mom and I said, let's celebrate my book signing. And she goes, just the two of us? And I go, well, yeah. And she goes, okay. So we went to this place. We both love rice pudding, the kind that's all heated and gooey and really delicious. We had,
oh, yeah, yum.
It was delicious. We went to this place that specialized in that. We ordered a big thing because they don't give it individually. It's a big thing. And two teas, and that was our celebration.
No, well done. No, rice pudding is a very nice guilty pleasure.
Yeah, it was delicious. Actually, we couldn't finish it. We took it home because it was just too much. But it was really good. But, yeah, sometimes you don't, you know, yeah, champagne and all that's really cool, but it's not the best thing, like, on a Saturday afternoon. and you're driving. You know?
That's really cool, though, that you had a signing at Barnes & Noble's, though. That's actually really cool.
Yeah, it was. It was really fun. It was, they said we did really well, too. They said I did almost as well as a couple of famous people who went there, which really surprised me. I said, you're kidding. He said, no.
Oh, well done. I've never had a book signing, but I've signed many books. I remember being at StokerCon earlier this year, and Lee Murray came up. And I had her book, and she had mine, and we signed each other's books, and it was, you know, made my heart go ooey gooey.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's really cool. What's really weird is my first book came out, and I'm a Xena fan, as you know, I told you. And I was at a Xena convention, and one of the girls there said, do you have your book? And I said, well, yeah, I have a few in my car, you know, because you always have it in your car in case you're going to, like, bring it into a bookstore or whatever. So I had some in my car, but I didn't bring it in. And they said, oh, bring it in. We have a table. We can set it up. I go, it's not Xena fiction. It's fiction. And they go, that's okay. And so they put it at a table, and then I only had like 8. I didn't have that many. And they said, oh, we're doing the signing too. I go, but those are all the books I have. So they said, well, give us half, and then take half for your signing. I sold all of them. I was really shocked. I didn't think I would. I didn't bring it in. I didn't think I was going to sell any of them. They all sold. That's how supportive the Xena fans are.
Well, one, well done on that. Two, you are absolutely 100% correct. You should always have a copy of your book on hand. I have not done up business cards for myself yet. I really need to do that. But when I go to conventions, even if I'm not like a guest or doing anything, I always have a copy of my book on hand to show people. And third, Xena. Xena was also one of the big factors as part of my Peplum book. It was so important to me to have a chapter about Xena in my book, and I was lucky to have, you know, actually two essays about Xena. In fact, when you do an academic book, you put a call for papers out there where people submit their abstracts to you. They say, I want to write about this. This is how I want to write about it. And I had a call open for 3 months for people to submit to me. And at the end of those 3 months, I did not have a single Xena chapter. And I'm like, I have to have a Xena chapter. You can't have a book on Peplum stuff in the 90s and not talk about how important Xena is. So I extended my call for papers another month. And then, boom, I get two Xena papers. And I was very happy for that because that really completed my book. I talk about Xena very much in my introduction as well, how important it is, how important its fandom is. You know, it really set the standards of fandom. You know, one of the first sword and sandal shows that, you know, have an internet presence, to have a fan community, to have its own conventions. And also, in its other regards, you know, female protagonists, the portrayal of, you know, identity and whatnot in it. Super important.
It is. And one thing people don't realize about the Xena community is how generous they are. They've given over the years, which has been a long time now, thousands and thousands of dollars to different charities. They always have at the Xena convention when they had it, which they don't anymore, they always have a charity auction. Certain guests, like Hudson, would she'd auction off the dress she's wearing, and for her charity, which was for cancer research for women. And they're such a generous lot, and of course they're very generous to each other. Like I said before, there's a kindness there. I mean, you can tell I'm still a fan, even though I don't shout it off to the rooftops anymore. I'll always be a fan. There's always going to be a part of me that's going to go towards the Xena show, the actors, the writers, the director, the producer, everybody involved. You got two essays, and that's all. It's kind of shocking because I know that there's more. Even educators out there that I personally know that are big Xena fans. So I'm a little surprised you only got two.
Well, two plus an afterword. My afterword was written by Stephen Sears. I'd known Stephen from a whole bunch of comic book conventions. We'd see him all the time. He'd be on a panel. He'd be wearing his, you know, hat, looking all cool and stately, and I just went up to him one day. I'm like, hey, Stephen, do you want to write the afterword for my book? And he said, absolutely, I'm totally interested. And he did. He wrote a wonderful afterword for my book. So he's my marquee value for my own book. So, yeah, so two essays plus an afterword by the man himself. And so
yeah.
I was all happy to see him at a con, give him his contributor copy, and have him sign my book. Dude, can you sign my own book that you're in? That's kind of a cool and surreal thing to do.
Steve is so supportive. He was the first real guest other than my test shows. He was the first real guest on my show. And he didn't even know what it was. I just said, hey, I'm starting this thing. Do you want to come on? He goes, okay.
No, he is so supportive and encouraging. He's full of stories, too, just the wonderful stories. If you run into him at a con, I hope you have an hour available because he will walk on to you and he will tell you the coolest stories that you know, heck to go into anyone else's panels or anything else. You want to hang out with Stephen and hear his stories.
Yes, he is extremely, he's like a modern day, like somebody like David Niven in the 50s, you know. He could tell stories about anything and everything and be fascinating. When I have him on my show, I always book extra time because I know Steve is incredibly interesting.
He is, and I did catch your guys' episode where you talked to him and Kevin J. Anderson, and I'd actually grown up reading so much of Kevin J. Anderson's Star Wars books, and so it was really nice to hear him talk about Stalag X. I'm like, oh my God, you know, here's a guy I worked with, and here's another guy that's written so much of my childhood, and, you know, they're on Sherry's podcast, or, you know, radio show. It's so cool.
I know. And Kevin also, I met him through Steven. Kevin's been very supportive of my show, too. And he's lovely and fun. And, yeah, together, I like having them together. They're so amazing. So we're getting to the end. I want to give you plenty of time. Why don't you tell about your newest book and where people can get it and any kind of personal events or online events that you're going to be at?
Sure. So the current project I'm working on, it's not available yet, but I'm co-editing a book with my girlfriend Michelle. We're both the co-chairs of the Ann Radcliffe Academic Conference. And this is a conference that we came up with about 2 years ago with the Horror Writers Association. And we've had two conferences. And, you know, those conferences have a variety of topics on horror studies. And what we did is we reached out to all our presenters who had something related to academia of horror literature. And we're combining them into a book that's going to be published by McFarland. We don't have a title for it yet. Our due date was earlier this month for all of our essayists to get our essays back to us. And so we have been knee-deep in editing all these horror literature essays, you know, from essays on Stephen King to Ann Radcliffe. And so it's really, really cool. So our manuscript is due back to the publisher, I believe, at the end of September. So that's kind of the big project that I'm working on right now. After that, I've got essays planned for other books and my own projects, but that's kind of the, you know, dig into the trenches and work on this book.
Well, you probably have a deadline approaching, right?
I do. I think the manuscript is due in September, and so this summer is basically editing the essays, getting them back to our writers, getting their revisions back, getting the introduction all composed. And so, it's kind of a cumbersome process, you know, since we're not writing this book ourselves, you know, we're working with other folks. And so there's a lot of back and forth emails, you know, talking about edits and everything. This point can be made clearer. This point could probably be dropped. So that's our entire summer is those dialogues, getting these essays prepared. And so I think it should be available in the spring. But again, don't have a title for it yet. I'll probably be up to the publisher to come up with that one because we're terrible at titles. But that's my current project. I would say the other things that have came out that I've been a part of was, you know, my Peplum book, the new Peplum. I had an essay in a book on Stranger Things that came out about 2 months ago. You know, all sorts of fun stuff.
Cool. And do you have any appearances that you're going to be doing, either in person or online?
I will probably be making appearances at the Long Beach Comic Con in September. I usually wind up being on a panel or two. I'll be at a He-Man convention in Torrance in August, but I'll be covering that as a news person, not as a guest or anything. But, hey, it's He-Man and She-Ra, so how cool is that?
How cool. And do you have a website or a way the fans can get in touch with you?
Sure. My website's pretty simple. It's just nickdiak.com, N-I-C-K-D-I-A-K. You can also do a Google search for me, Nicholas Dyack. There's only two of us out there, so you got a 50-50 chance to get the right one. And at my website, you can find all the links to my social media, my Facebook, my Twitter, and all that stuff. I'm, you know, having a last name that's pretty unique, Dyack. You know, it's pretty easy to hunt me down.
Yeah, that is a different name. So there's actually two?
Yeah, there's another Nick Dyack out there, and I've met him. He does a lot of Star Wars art and everything. He's a really cool guy. So I call him my doppelganger.
That would be funny if you guys, like, cooperated and did you did a Star Wars book, and he did the artwork, and then he could say Nick Dyack and Nick Dyack.
That would be really funny. We'd probably have to differentiate ourselves if our middle names or something.
Well, like a middle initial or something, maybe.
Absolutely.
That would be really cool. Anyway, we've come to the end. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. I hope you enjoyed yourself.
I really had a blast. Thank you so much for having me. I hope you keep cool with the SoCal heat. And I wish you all the very best with your own writing and your show. And again, with sincerity, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome. And thank you so much for coming on the show. And thank you for chatting and sharing.
No problem. Cheers. Cheers.